Good evening, everybody. James McKenney here with my science hour, that is. August 24th, 2023, and a lot of topics to cover tonight. What I've been doing lately, now go back to August 3rd and 10th, I concentrated on commentary on the atomic bomb because of the Oppenheimer movie, a lot of publicity, a lot of commentary, both positive and negative, and all. And none of them that I saw really hit the target point of all of this. And so anyway, I spent my August 3rd and 10th shows. So if you did not listen to those, go back and listen. And then last week, I jumped back into science where I'm doing, I have a lot of information that comes in every week. And so I picked some of these stories that I think really are noteworthy and passed them on to you, of course, with my own variation of commentary. Okay, so the X-RISM spacecraft. Okay, now this is an X-ray telescope built by NASA, community effort, NASA in Japan. Now, Japan has a very active space program. They're very good at what they do, and this X-ray telescope is going to put a whole new dimension on outer space. Because X-rays are one of the least understood aspects of what's going on in outer space. When they originally started looking at high-energy phenomena, they thought, oh, just objects like the sun or like galaxies or supernovas, other objects in the universe are like black holes, for example, the event horizon around the black hole. You might see X-rays. But then they just started to discover X-rays everywhere, in the atmosphere, above thunderstorms, below thunderstorms. They started discovering them on the front side of comets, something that I had some major contributions. In fact, I predicted that in my original paperwork. That was the three-part comet paper, which was a derivation of the book that I wrote when I was at Cornell, and I was working on publishing these papers when I got short-stopped. X-rays in comets. Now, what causes X-rays in comets? Well, if they were dirty snowballs, you would be hard-pressed to understand where they might have X-rays. And so when they were finally discovered, the discovery was literally by accident. They pointed a telescope, an X-ray telescope, mistakenly at a comet and saw X-rays. And they go, what's this? An X-ray signature out in front of comets. And then they looked at another comet. There was Hyakutake was the original one, a small comet that was coming relatively close to Earth. And they saw X-rays, and so they pointed the telescope at Hale-Bopp, which was another fairly large comet in the solar system at the time, and lo and behold, same thing. 30,000 miles out to the sunward side of the comet, there you go, X-rays. You know, so how is an ice ball, what's supposed to be this delicate little coldest thing in the universe, thing that comes in from the far reaches of the coldest region of outer space, where there's no starlight, there's no sunlight, there's nothing to warm it up. The coldest region, you know, anywhere in outer space, these ice ball comets are supposed to come from, and all of a sudden they're producing X-rays. Holy cow, how does that work? Well, I predicted it because comets are not dirty snowballs. They are the discharge of the solar capacitor, which is a high energy process. And so if you take, let's go back to Kepler, who is one of the first people to talk about the comets potentially being some kind of an ice ball that melts when it gets near the sun. Kepler and those guys were the first ones to really understand that comets were out there in the atmosphere. They, you know, Aristotle had been, his philosophy, his teachings had been taught all the way up through the Middle Ages. And so Newton, all those guys were taught Aristotelian philosophy and science, if you want to call it that. And Newton changed a lot of that. For example, one of the Aristotelian teachings was that a body would come to rest naturally, and that's part of motion, is coming to rest. And Newton says, no, if there's nothing to resist it, that thing will just keep going on forever. And Newton was the first guy that really identified friction. But anyway, it was this whole group of people who were able to, they understood the orbits, for example, of comets, and they understood that the orbits were out there, not in our atmosphere, but out in outer space. And they were, they understood that the planets went around the sun in near circular orbits, and that comets were in these elliptical orbits. And of course, Halley was in on that too, Edmund Halley, after which is named Comet Halley, his namesake, which comes back every 70 some years. And anyway, the tail points away from the sun. I mean, the only visible that they had, the only visuals that they had at the time, were the comet tail. The only visual thing they had to really go by is that the sun's over here, the comet is there, the tail points away. They could not see the plasma tail. Eventually, sometimes they could see other effects. And then historically, if you went back in history, people talked about the sunward discharge of comets, which is a fairly rare phenomenon, but it is visible. And so the end result was that they said, oh, well, it gets close to the sun. It must be something there melting. And that was Kepler. And Halley thinking this. So the idea of this comet being something that melts or sublimates is the correct term, where it goes directly from the solid to the gas state. That goes way back to the, you know, Middle Ages. And so in that replaced Aristotelian concept that a comet was fire in the atmosphere. That was what Aristotle taught. Okay, so anyway, now we come all the way up through the 1800s and the 1900s, and every now and then somebody said, you know, there's something more going on here, but they really didn't have an idea. Then I came along and did my work at Cornell, and, you know, I said, Nate, these things are not dirty snowballs. It doesn't add up. And then more data was available, and I came up with the concept of the solar capacitor, that the comet is the discharge of the solar capacitor, that the big ones can become planets because of the tail drag. They can have their orbits changed because of the tail drag, and that's what circularizes their orbits, and on, the rest is history. And I predicted that because of this electron discharge that's on the sunward side of comets, that there would be a high energy signature there. It could be ultraviolet, could be x-rays, it could be gamma rays in the big comets. And so I just stated that, you know, it could be x-rays or high energy phenomenon out to the sunward side, because when that electron beam, part of the electrical discharge, comes in from the sun, it's pinched. So it's a beam, literally pinched, a very narrow stream of electrons. When it hits that comet atmosphere, or the cloud, the coma around the comet nucleus, when it hits that, it's going to create X-rays. The other thing that's going to happen is it's going to see the charged nucleus, and it's going to break the electrons, causing what are known as breaking X-rays. Bremsstrahlung X-rays is the German term. That's the typical physics term. So I predicted this 1979, and they weren't discovered till 1996 by accident. And so anyway, there are all kinds of places in the universe where there are X-rays, including places where you just might not expect them. So this new X-ray telescope being put up by NASA in Japan will be very interesting, because now we'll have a telescope that's dedicated to X-ray photography in outer space. And let me just say something too for all of the people out there that believe in the Big Bang or the general relativity and black holes and things like that. You can allegedly, because none of those are true. The Big Bang is not true. general relativity is not true. In fact, Einstein was supportive of that himself. Einstein did not believe general relativity. So anyway, the event horizon where particles are the electrons are stripped off and they accelerate in under the so-called force of gravity and into this what is known as the event horizon, the point at which light, not even light, can escape from a black hole, an alleged black hole, because there's no such thing as a black hole either. But anyway, what you get there is those that acceleration produces X-rays in the theoretical world. So they see X-rays outside of the region around certain stars and quasars, for example, but it's not due to a black hole. It's due to electrical phenomena. Okay, so at any rate, this will be very interesting. It'll be very interesting to see the science results of these telescopes. Unfortunately, when they put a lot of these into space, they put on the team, they put these old scientists or, weathered in their ways on the standard scientific concepts. So nothing new gets done. That's one of the big unfortunate things with space science when they put a new spacecraft into outer space, or in this case, an X-ray prism telescope, that it will really not produce good science. It'll produce a lot of the same old thing that's been happening. Okay. This is kind of talking about black holes. This is kind of comical because for a while I commented on this show and people would write in. Actually, people were writing to me saying, hey, every place I go, there's a black hole. There's black holes over there, it's in your closet, black holes everywhere. And so there was a social media post that there was a black hole discovered in somebody's the center column in their automobile, and it talked about the type of automobile. But they, and it was just a kind of a spoof, because even the public is waking up to the idea that every time you look at a video or anytime you look on the news, hey, there's a black hole over there. Everything's a black hole now. And it could be little ones, the size of your thumbnail, a black hole, which of course is preposterous. But it was getting to that point, and then finally, even the general public started to make fun of it. Anyway, very interesting to see that. This following story. Now, last week I talked about an archaeological find in China, in southern China, where they found 47 human teeth that were from 13 different individuals. But the bodies of the people were not there. These teeth were washed in by a flood into this cave. There was part of a human skull there, which was modern human, and these were like 80,000 years old. Some people believe up to 300,000 years old. So my point last week was that by seeing these teeth that were washed in by a flood, there had to be a lot of that had to have been a lot of people. Potentially, and just doing the math, I mean, what's the probability that somebody's tooth gets washed into a cave? If they're living down the road a little ways, it ain't going to happen. So you can make mathematical, statistical calculations to determine the number of people that must have been living in that area at the time when this great flood occurred, and the great floods occur because comets come by. Causing large tsunamis. So this is a very powerful wave that comes in. And so there had to be people in the area, let's just put it that way. And you say, oh, maybe one guy was just living there. Well, the teeth were from 13 different people, 47 teeth, 13 different people, and washed into this cave. And what's the probability of that? Okay, well, there were at least 13 people we know of that were around that cave at the time. And the thing is that these were modern teeth from modern man, and not but 80,000 years old. The entire point here is that archaeology is really, really incorrect in its interpretation of human history. So what I wanted to bring up this week is another story, a very similar story, where this woman's discovered, and it once again it's a skull, because the skull bones last a lot longer than, like, say, the femurs or the finger bones or anything like that. They have a much bigger core and decay much sooner. But the skull is one of those bones that just sticks around for a very long time. So anyway, in the case of this woman, this was discovered, and it was in the Czech Republic. Actually discovered in 1950. So this was known about for a long time. But it just shows you how remiss the archaeological community is to introducing real new data. And the result is that a group recently took this woman's, the remains of the skull, and with building a model using, features like muscle tone, and they reconstructed what the woman must have looked like. And she looks like, you know, the lady living down the street. And the age on this one was 45,000 years ago. And you would think, well, why aren't we finding these all over the place? And the result is the same situation, where a large, when these earthwide catastrophes happen, it's really devastating. It's really, really devastating. And a lot of times it's accompanied by large tsunamis. And I'm not talking about the little ones that you might see, you know, on a video. You go on the internet and there's like a kind of a wave coming in and it washes a few houses away. No, this is a 1,000-foot wave that comes in and literally takes everything with it. And like I've said before, it's compared to a city like, say, New York City. It would come in, and on the way out, it would literally take everything with it. There wouldn't be anything left. You think, oh, all those big buildings. No, the big buildings would be gone. And even Christ talks about this in the Bible when they're talking about the end day prophecies and what's it going to be like. And he goes, you know, there's not going to be a stone left upon a stone. That's how bad it's going to be. You know, and people go, well, what kind of earthquake on a Richter scale? Well, we're talking, you know, a really bad earthquake on Earth would be like a 6 or 7 or maybe an 8 or a 9. Really, really bad, because it goes up. Richter scale is logarithmic. So you go from 6 to 7, that's 10 times worse. From 7 to 8, that's 10 times worse again. So 8 is 100 times worse than a 6, etc. And so they say, what kind of scale, what kind of earthquake on a Richter scale might it be? And I said, maybe a 20. That's how bad it's going to be, and very few people live through it. And for some reason, the human race has managed to survive quite a few of these events. But this woman's skull, 45,000 years old, and a modern human. So modern humans have been on this planet going back as far as we can see to the present day, hundreds of thousands of years. So this story that somehow man developed in the Mesopotamia Valley, you know, and with the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and all of the races of man somehow evolved out of this little group of people. No, bogus story, couldn't possibly be true. And now we're getting a very clear idea of what happened. But see, they won't, archaeology is a field that is stagnant. It's been stagnant. And the people in charge of archaeological finds, it's a two-way street. If anything is really found, that goes up the ladder, and that's part of the secret societies. It's their, one of their sacred things. And it's the other part is anything that's found is not passed down to the public, to keep the public stupid. So they pawn off on the public all kinds of stupid things that don't make any sense, like man being generated in Mesopotamia 7,000 years ago. They ignored the Great Flood. They ignored the Moses event where Venus, the comet, came by. You know, all of this gets swept under the rug. They take a guy like Velikovsky who is an absolute, probably one of the top scientists along with Einstein. In fact, they were neighbors. Einstein and Velikovsky were good friends. And I know that because I was good friends with Werner Sizemore, who was Velikovsky's personal secretary. And so he would tell about how Einstein would come over to Velikovsky's house for supper, play the violin, and eat supper. And, you know, they were good friends. And but also psychologically and also mentally in a very high category. And then Velikovsky was just treated just horribly by somebody mentally much, much less, much his lesser, let's put it that way, use a little old English. And, you know, Sagan and the boys just buried Velikovsky literally. And it's what they do. They muddy him up. It's not enough that they just say, oh, he was wrong. They had to call him the crazy old man, and, you know, pseudoscience, all these other terms they made up to call Velikovsky. But in the end, Velikovsky was right. Venus was a comet, came by Earth on various occasions, caused a tremendous amount of devastation, and there's no question that he was right about this. And the Sagans and the other people, the Neil deGrasse Tysons, who, well, he wasn't even around in the time of Velikovsky, but were completely wrong. Anyway, here we have another case of a human, modern human, living 45,000 years ago. And by the way, this is about the time frame that the Neanderthals finally succumbed and died out. But something seems to be very clear, that the Neanderthal may have mixed somewhat with other local populations, but there were other populations that were prevalent and very advanced civilizations. So you had this Neanderthal contingency mainly in Central Europe, and it appears that they were able to live through some of these events because they lived very central to the continent, the European continent. And, you know, that seems to be a plausible explanation. Whereas, you know, other modern societies possibly live closer to the coast and were totally destroyed when these tsunamis came in. We know, for example, there's right in the Bible, they talk about Pharaoh's army living in or crossing the Red Sea with the chariots, and they, in fact, I remember the National Geographic article where they showed the photographs of the Pharaoh's chariots buried in the Red Sea in the sand underneath the water, right where they were crossing. There was kind of like this isthmus. The Israelites got to that point, and they were waiting, and, you know, the movement of waters, the gravitational wave of the comet, moved the waters and it gave them time to cross over to the other side. And when Pharaoh and his armies went in after him, the water swooshed back and buried him. You know, those are historical events. And like so many other things related to comet science, they're trying to keep this information from the public, or they are keeping it, and very effectively for decades. Why do you think they don't want people to really understand what comets are? Because if they did, they would understand their history, their true history. They would understand that potentially these things can happen again, and the world controllers would lose control. That's their whole motivation for everything, is control. Okay, just a quick comment here. Now, more and more today, you're hearing about the idea that Neanderthal man is part of the DNA of everybody. Like, you know, everybody out there has a little piece of Neanderthal man DNA in them. And here is my estimate, because sometimes, like this woman I was telling you about that was discovered, you know, her skull was discovered in the Czech Republic in 1950. And they were even mentioning that even her DNA had a little bit of Neanderthal man, when this is possible. But when it gets down to a couple percent, a few percent, What I'm thinking is that I don't believe it. I don't believe that the tracing of DNA is accurate enough to proclaim somebody is a couple percent of anything. And just from a general scientific perspective, because you're dealing with, let's take a DNA chain, it's a molecular chain, and you're telling me that 3% of that belongs to a certain ancestral group. I don't believe it. I don't believe that you can measure that. I don't believe you can determine that. The computer may say that. And for example, when this is a great example, when they were doing reconstruction of the COVID-19, the people that really understood what was happening there understood that the process, in fact, the guy who invented the process of determining whether there was a probability of something being a certain molecular chain or not, said that it doesn't apply. That what they do is they take something, they chop it up into a million pieces, and then they examine the pieces. And those pieces could be from something, they might be from something else. But when they get down to a couple percent, saying a couple percent is Neanderthal man, I don't believe it. I don't believe that they can specify that. And they should not be putting that in the news media because it is false information. It's misleading information. They want everybody out there to think they're basically, when you think of Neanderthal, you think of caveman, because the Neanderthals never really progressed. They died out, but the human race as we know it today lived on. You know, there's something strange going on with this, the whole concept of Neanderthal man. The Europeans are very good at tracing back their genetics and to human people like you and me that lived throughout Europe that go back in history, and they know the numbers. You know, if it goes back to a certain time, B.C., or, you know, whatever the time frame was, they know how many people lived in certain regions and then the growth rate. And once they started growing in numbers, then they have population counts because of the archaeology down there, because of the mathematics that comes with archaeology, just like I was talking about the teeth. I was talking about this last week, the teeth that were in the cave. I was just mentioning that. You can do mathematics. You can, and there's a really good book. A friend of mine, Mark Gaffney, wrote a book. It's called Deep History of Man. That's what it's called. And the premise is that in the cave in England and other locations and other scientific discoveries, you can make mathematical extrapolations using the data. And so, and I think when they're going around talking about everybody having a little piece of Neanderthal DNA, I think that is really misleading. Hey, jumping off to a different topic now, you may know that I'm involved in the energy business with my patented wing generator, etc. And what is shocking to me, here's some stories that have come out recently. The electrical vehicle industries, many of the companies that jumped in on this and are want to make electrical vehicles, EVs, are folding. And you can just see them one right after the other, that they're going out of business. The whole issue is, well, there's many issues with electric vehicles. But what I want to talk about today is the fact that Siemens and General Electric are both going broke. they're posting tremendous losses, like billions with a B, billions of dollars lost per year, and even in subparts of the year, in quarterly losses. How can companies, now just put this into perspective. The United States and Europe are putting trillions of dollars into alternative energy. You know, whether you like it or not, I think it's the equipment that's out there, three-blade wind turbines and solar, don't work, so don't put a penny into them. You know, they simply don't work, but they're giving wind and alternative energy a bad name. But okay, be that as it may, you have a demand for energy. The energy prices are going up. You have record high gas prices in the United States, in Europe, every place. You have record high prices for energy. That contributes to record high prices for everything else because if you buy a hot dog at the ballpark, 95% of the cost of that hot dog is energy. You know, the farm where the meat was raised, the processing of the meat being hauled to market, being cooled, being shipped to the store where it's refrigerated. You buy it, you take it home, you put it in the refrigerator at the ballpark, they put it in the cooler at the ballpark. The guy that sells it had to drive to work to sell it to you. A big part of his personal expense is gasoline, just so he can go to the ballpark and sell it to you. The ballpark has energy expenses that has to be paid for out of the money that you pay for that hot dog at the ballpark. It's 95% energy cost in any product, and that's probably conservative. Okay. These countries, these the United States, Europe, and every place else in the world has record energy prices. There is tremendous demand for energy. China is building, allegedly, this is what I've heard, they're bringing on a new coal power plant every week to meet the energy demand in China. So the world has immense hunger for energy. It's high priced. There's vast amounts of money being put into this by governments, just throwing it at it. There are tax incentives. There are development money. There are government agencies, the National Wind Energy, the Department of the Department of Energy, that specialize to help these companies advance, you know, to certify them. Everything, all of the advantages are there for these companies. How can they be going broke? It's phenomenal. I mean, how is this even possible that these companies are posting losses when the demand for energy, and now look at what they're doing is selling equipment. The real business model, if they sold something that worked, why would they even sell it? They'd simply go out and put some up, start selling the energy, and then with the money they make off of that, install more. With the money they make off of that, put some of it into building more. And they would sell the energy, which is going to go on forever and ever and ever. That would be the real business model if they were selling something that worked. But what they're selling is a one-off. They're going to sell a unit or 10 units or 15 or 20 or 100 or whatever it is. And then they get the profit from that, and that's their only profit. In a world that is hungry, demanding energy, putting all their resources into energy, and these companies making alternative energy products are going broke. Excuse me, if there's anybody out there that can explain this to me, you know, I'm pretty good at math, I'm pretty good at economics, I've learned business the hard way by doing it, and I'm not that good a business person, I'll admit that, but still, how on earth can these companies be losing money in the world energy environment in which we live? They have a captive market They are the biggest producers of this kind of equipment on the planet. How can they be going broke? This should be the most lucrative growing business that you ever heard of. I am just, okay, I can't even talk anymore. It's just so ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Okay, another story along the same line. And there's, by the way, there's a good organization here. If you want to get the daily scoop on all of the dirty work, the dirty politics, everything else going on in the wind industry that's bad and corrupt, which it is, it's called windwatch.org. And there's a dash in there. So wind and watch are separated by a center dash. wind-watch.org. And get on their mailing list. But here's an article. The blades of the three-blade wind turbines, they don't know what to do with them. Once they're out of service, which in a lot of cases they're out of service very quickly, they take these things and they put them in a, you know, they bury them or they take them and throw them in a field. We've seen these where they just take them and dump them someplace out in the middle of nowhere. But it turns out that the most toxic substance known to man is called bisphenol, and it's used in both fiberglass and resin type applications. But this leaches out of the blades that are out there, and even when they're up in the air, this is leaching out into the ground. It is literally called the most toxic substance known to man, if you can even imagine that. And you have thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of these three-blade wind turbines out there leaching this into the ground, which is going to go right into the groundwater. Unbelievable. I just, literally, this is what it says. The most toxic substance known to man, bisphenol, in this, it's a major element in the three-blade wind turbine blades. Now, that's one thing. When I was developing the wing generator, I was very conscious of something called recycling. And so, in other words, the materials that you use to build whatever it is, they come from a metal, you know, it takes heat and energy to create metal to form them. But can you reuse them, and how long do they last? A lot of the three-blade wind turbines don't even last a year or two. They're already sitting there idle. So at any rate, just another nail in the coffin of alternative energy as we know it today, the three-blade wind turbines. And this whole thing to fail was by design, because GE and Siemens, their core business is Central Power Company power. Okay, this is an interesting story. Now, I've been talking for years about the Wikipedia being just a horrifically bad source. It started out as an online, and this is back in, the early 2000s. It started out as everybody could contribute encyclopedia. It soon was taken over, and especially the first place to go was the sciences. And it was very clear, I knew this, that the CIA had taken it over. And basically, you know, turned it into a political sounding box for the agendas that they wanted to promote. Well, the problem is that most students, whether in grade school or high school or college, if they were set out to write a term paper or some kind of study, the very first place they went to was Wikipedia, and so it became a one of the teaching tools for the CIA, the world bankers, and the agendas that they wanted to promote, whether it was climate change, whether it was whatever agenda it was, one of the thousands that are out there today, it was promoted through Wikipedia. Recently, Glenn Greenwald, a radio talk show host, internet personality, interviewed Larry Sanger. Now, Larry Sanger was one of the original founders of Wikipedia, and he left it after a while, went on to do different things. But the question was, when did this happen to Wikipedia? When did it get taken over? And what was the who was doing it, etc.? And of course, the same answer that I came up with a long time ago is that the CIA did this. No, CIA has taken over all of the social medias. And what they do is they let, like when something emerges like social media, or in the current case, artificial intelligence, or let's say Bitcoin or crypto monetary systems, they'll let the independent developers run with it for a while and compete and see who comes up with the best system, etc. And in social media, the winners were Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and etc. And of course, we know from the Twitter files now, after Musk bought it and released everything, that it was just corrupt to the core. The CIA actually had people working in the offices in Twitter, and Twitter had people working in the CIA. And it was, the suppression of truth, the suppression of people's voices, the suppression of political candidates that they didn't agree with, on and on and on. And that, that is rampant in YouTube. You take any of the social medias, because those are the winners. Those are the ones that got out there in front. Those are the ones that succeeded. And then when those emerging companies come in, CIA comes in with a boatload of money. Now, where does the CIA get money? From their drug and human trafficking. And so they invested in high technology companies, companies that they can use to control the public. So the CIA for a long time has controlled, for example, the Office of the President of the United States, the corporation, you might say. But who is the CIA? They are the police force of the World Bank, and basically have unlimited money. There's this kind of front, this facade that they put up, like the people say, oh, the CIA, this is their annual budget or something. No, they have nothing to do with the United States. They never did. When the Dulles boys, the brothers, and the entourage of white guys started the CIA, they were the poster child. They were the poster boys that made it look like it was an American and good and all of this. But no, this is strictly a banker entity to run everything in the world. You know, they affect governments in countries. They go in and there's the book, Perkins' book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's how he worked for the CIA and would go into countries and they would maneuver. In like a salesman, they would first make their pitch to the local government. And for example, in Africa, when COVID came in, they literally killed 8 presidents in Africa who were refusing to go with the COVID shot stuff. 8 presidents within Africa. So this is going on today. They control like all of the different, attempts to try and destroy Trump. All came out of the CIA. And the FBI is just a subarm of the CIA. All of the American agencies come under the heading of the CIA, including the NSA. So what they do is they control the news media, the court systems, the governor's office. They, in most states, they control the legislators. They compromise the senators, the U.S. senators. And, it's just a big, filthy, dirty network. And also they're related to Mossad and the British branch of the same. These are all under the Vatican Bank. The Rothschild banking system is the front agency. Back to Wikipedia. Wikipedia started out as like any other good-intentioned internet service, and it was supposed to be where anybody and everybody could write in and post their information, so it would be a public knowledge type of place, only to find out that within a very short amount of time it was completely taken over. And Glenn Greenwald's page, go there. I just want to recommend people go there because it's got a lot of good information. But it's interesting to see one of the founders of Wikipedia coming out and saying that yes, the CIA controls Wikipedia. And like I'm adding to that, saying that they control just about everything. And when I say just about, there are things today that are emerging, like artificial intelligence, where they have a hand in it already, but they let these independent companies run, see what kind of developments come out of it, and then they swoop in for the kill, and then they support the companies that they want to have there, and the other ones they run out of business. Just a dirty game of international economics, of politics, and just about everything that exists. So they certainly don't like me because I expose what they're doing. They don't like exposure. A cockroach doesn't like light. They're afraid of light because what do? They're going to steal your food, and of course they hide under cover of darkness. Okay, changing topics a little bit here. Last week, or actually about 2 weeks ago now, the island of Maui in the Hawaiian island chain had a devastating fire. There were fires in other parts of the island chain, but the city of Lahaina, a place that I've visited, like probably everybody that's listening. I bet you 80% of the people here have been to Lahaina. It's the old whaling town, so it had a lot of old charm. And of course, burned literally to the ground because of wildfires moving in the area. Horrific loss of life, loss of one of the most charming places on the planet. And something that it seems like no matter how much you might prepare, and there are groups, I believe I was watching the news, no matter how much you prepare, you still cannot prepare for the time when it actually happens. Lahaina had a lot of homeless people, a lot of people that probably had no transportation, that lived there and only would walk to wherever they were going to. There were reports of people, excuse me, jumping into the ocean trying to get away from the fires, people trying to rescue them, the boats in the harbor burning up. Just a scene out of almost like a war movie. So anyway, there are ways to help these people. The federal government has come in as a disaster relief, which they should, because this is a true disaster. But our hearts go out to these people who literally one day they were there, they were working, they were functioning, and the next day everything was gone. And it should remind probably the rest of us that this dangerous game that they're playing in Ukraine, sacrificing a country for the New World Order plan of keeping Russia and the United States divided, is insane. It's insanity. Gerald Celente, who has the Trends Journal, I've been written up in Trends Journal. They wrote, I think it was Ben Davis, the journalist from Trends, sought me out and wrote an article in the I forget the year, it might have been in like one of the 2018, something like that, about the wing generator and getting water from the air with some of my products in the wing generator line and in the water filter line. But Gerald Celente recently spearheaded a discussion with Scott Ritter, I believe was there, a number of people giving a talk in front of the United Nations. And of course, the United Nations is nowhere to be found anymore. And when their purpose was set up to go into areas where there's conflict and set up UN peacekeeping groups and say, okay, you guys stay over here, you guys stay over here and stop the shooting, and we're going to try and resolve these issues. But the UN has become nothing more than a kind of like a gasoline can to throw gasoline on the fire, or at least to simply stay out of the way when international conflicts occur. And of course, like everything else, became owned and basically operated by the CIA, the World Bank, the New World Order. So the UN has become just like NATO had some original purpose after World War II to organize, and there's nothing wrong with organizing for the defense of an area for countries or whatever. But now it's grown into an offensive, basically an offensive machine to poke Russia. And so, anyway, the Gerald Celente, well, and these, you can look on both sides. People say, well, he's wrong about this. The point is, they got to stop this conflict. It should have never gotten going in the first place. It should have never gotten to the point where it is right now, with the U.S. sending billions of dollars in money, much of that money going into the black market, much of that money being kicked back to U.S. congressmen, much of that the armament being sold on the black market, a lot of it never getting to the designated locations. And the expansion of NATO, which it never should have done in the first place, it was the only reason that, anyway, I'm not going to go into all the politics of NATO, but the end result is that the wars in the world just have to stop. This insanity, where they pick a country and destroy it completely, has just got to stop. It's not a way to resolve conflicts. That nobody wins. There are no winners. People say, oh, well, they're going to win the war. No, nobody is winning any. Nobody has ever won a war. I think you could say it this way. There are countries that have lost wars, but no country has ever won a war. Let's just put it that way. But the fires in Maui and Lahaina remind you of a war zone. That's why I got off on that tangent. But back to the poor people in Hawaii. It's a poor state. Hawaii is one of the poorest states in the Union. And to have this happen to an entire town that's been there for literally hundreds of years, Lahaina was a whaling port city. Because in the wintertime, the whales come in that is like a big calm area, and that's where they have their calves. And they stay there until the calves get big enough, and then they go back up. I believe they go back up to Alaska, one of their major fishing areas. But that coast off of Lahaina was a whaling area. And I always thought that whalers were these tough guys who are out in the ocean, and the whaling songs and all of that. But out there it was like shooting apples in a barrel. The whales were just kind of swimming around out there. So it wasn't like the New England whalers where they were out on the open ocean. It was a much different scenario. But anyway, be that as it may, one of my observations of the history of the whaling industry. But Lahaina itself was this quaint little town, very magical, just had a character of its own, and to see it completely gone, and of course everything built out of wood, very dry, and so when the fires came in, the wildfires came in, it just everything caught on fire. It was just, you know, and with high winds, there were apparently there's a hurricane offshore that's driving the winds, and they said up to 60 mile an hour winds with dry conditions and the fire. But once again, look for the places online where you can help these people, and I'm sure it will be rebuilt, but it'll never have the charm that it had, you know, previously. And but one other comment in listening to the news media reporting and the people there, they brought in invasive species have been brought in that were much more prone to fire. So all I can say is God help the people there, and we all have them in our prayers. Okay, I'm a couple minutes left here just to remind you that my MR5 whole house water filters are on sale. Remind you that I have a Patreon channel. It's patreon.com/jmccsci. Those are the same call letters as my web page, my main web page, jmccsci.com, and encourage people to go there. You have the grow towers where you can grow tremendous amounts of food in a small place with very little water. They have the reference, the link to the water filter page, the jmccwaterfilters.com page. We have the my books, my education package, science education for K-12 and their parents, available there. At a very, very reasonable price for what you get, hundreds of hours of lectures with all my books and the other materials, tremendously good deal, very educational with a Christian understanding of science. Now, that's something you're not going to see anyplace else. The also on my webpage, remember, the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage, I have the 4 and 10 packs of filter elements that are replacement filter elements for the gravity water filters. Anyone made after the in since the 1990s, any of these gravity water filters, my filters will fit, and they're the best and least expensive filters on the market. So go there and use the coupon code JMCC for an extra discount. And anyway, like I say, see if you can help these poor people in Hawaii. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.